This is Word for Word, Public Radio's national speech series from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava. Next month, the winnowing process begins. Iowans go to the caucuses January 3rd and cast the first votes of the 2008 presidential election. New Hampshire, the first state with a primary, comes quick on its heels less than a week later on January 8th. And as in other recent elections, the candidates have been campaigning hard in those two states, hoping an early victory will give them a boost in the rest of the country. Last week on Word for Word, we heard highlights from the Republican presidential candidates' stump speeches in Iowa and New Hampshire. This hour, we'll hear from the Democrats. It's your chance to hear some of the policy positions they've outlined and the promises they've made on the campaign trail. Just as we did last week with the Republicans, we'll hear the Democratic candidates in alphabetical order. There are eight of them: Senator Joe Biden of Delaware, Senator Hillary Clinton of New York, Senator Chris Dodd of Connecticut, former Senator John Edwards of North Carolina, former Senator Mike Gravel of Alaska, Congressman Dennis Kucinich of Ohio, Senator Barack Obama of Illinois, and Governor Bill Richardson of New Mexico. We'll begin with Joe Biden speaking late last month in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Biden, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, began his remarks by talking about President Bush's troop buildup in Iraq.
I've been hearing a lot lately about from my Republican colleagues about how the surge is working. Their attempt to defend the Bush-Cheney surge, in my view, totally misses the point and is misleading the American public. It is true, and by the way, I've been to Iraq more than every Democratic candidate combined, and I've been to Iraq more than anyone running for president of the United States of America. So I don't say this from afar. Security in Iraq is better, though it remains incredibly dangerous and incredibly violent, and the violence is incredibly high. That's great news that it's better, and is due in no small measure to the extraordinary skill, and I don't use the word lightly, bravery of our American troops. The American troops are able to accomplish any mission we have given them. Over and over and over again, they've done their job as we've assigned it to them. The problem is, the president has not done his job. Remember, the stated purpose of the surge, the president's stated purpose of the surge, was to allow for breathing room. For what purpose? To bring the Iraqis together so they'd reach a political compromise and end their civil war. There is no evidence, I emphasize, none, that this has happened. And there is no evidence, none, that it will happen so long as the Bush administration and those who support it continue to cling to the failed strategy of thinking it's possible to set up a strong central government in Baghdad capable of gaining the support of all the Iraqi people. That is the fundamental strategic flaw in this administration's policy. Here are the facts on the ground. There is no trust within the central government. There is no trust of the central government by the people. And there's no capacity on the part of the central government to deliver basic needs and services of the Iraqi people. Simply put, absent an occupation we cannot sustain and we should not sustain, or the return of a dictator, Iraq cannot be governed from the middle at this time in its history. There is only one path to a durable political settlement in Iraq. It does something very basic. It decentralizes power, gives the Iraqis local control over local police, jobs, education, and services. It keeps a limited central government to distribute oil revenues, and it brings in the United Nations to oversee the political settlement. It's what the Iraqi Constitution calls for. Article 1 says, quote, "We are a decentralized federal system." That's what the Iraqi Constitution says. Right now, the Bush administration has a huge opportunity to use this relative decrease in violence to abandon its failed policy of a strong central government, bring in the international community into the effort to make federalism work, while starting to draw down American forces. But the president and his would-be successors remain wedded to this failed strategy, which is, in my view, prolonging the war with no end in sight. But there is a policy. They have this huge opportunity to bring in the international community to make it work. And you say, why would they come in? Ladies and gentlemen, I asked for a private meeting with the permanent five of the Security Council, and they all met with me in a private meeting at the United Nations for an hour and a half. They are ready. They are ready to convene an international conference on Iraq, because if we leave and leave in disarray, that country will not split into three easy pieces. It will break into six or seven parts and be the most destabilizing event in modern Middle Eastern history. It will mean war for Turkey. It will mean Iran will be engaged directly with troops. It'll mean there will be a path being beaten by the Kurds from 500 to a million of them heading to Germany. And it will mean the radicalization of the 14% of the French population. Remember, it was only a year ago last August that you were seeing cars firebombed from Marseille to Normandy over headscarves. So they want to be engaged. But the president and his would-be successors remain wedded to this failed strategy, which is a prolonged war with no end in sight. They're using American soldiers to keep the lid on the violence, but they lack a political plan to prevent chaos from returning as soon as our troops leave. This is not just Joe Biden saying this. This is a number two general in Iraq heralding the success the troops is having said, but there's a very small window in which we have for the Iraqis to arrive at a political settlement, and I see no movement. It's time for the president to do his job. Our troops are doing theirs. It's a stopgap strategy, and the result will be more Americans' lives lost, more treasure spent, more damage to our military, without any chance of success. That, in my judgment, is unconscionable.
Democratic presidential candidate and Delaware Senator Joe Biden, who chairs the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, speaking late last month on the campaign trail in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Last week on Word for Word, we heard highlights from the Republican candidate's stump speeches. This week, we turn our attention to the Democrats. Up next, as we proceed in alphabetical order, is New York Senator and former First Lady Hillary Clinton. Clinton outlined her 10-year, $150 billion plan to encourage renewable energy during a speech last month at the Clipper Wind Power Wind Turbine Factory in Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
I have been looking forward to being here because I know how important it is that those of us who are running for president, asking the good people of Iowa for your support, that we tell you what we will do when we're president to deal with the big problems facing America. And today I want to focus on energy and climate change. The last two decades of the 20th century were the hottest in 400 years. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change found that 11 of the past 12 years are among the warmest since 1850. Rising sea levels along the coastal United States could cost $170 billion in the coming decades. Meanwhile, we are more dependent on foreign oil today than we were on 9/11. And one-third of our trade deficit is the petroleum we import, as we transfer massive amounts of wealth to undemocratic governments that use those funds to stifle opposition and finance extremism. This is the biggest challenge we have faced in a generation. It is a challenge to our economy, to our security, to our health, and to our planet. And it's time for America to meet it. It is time to get back into the solutions business. And that is what America does better than anybody else. When I am president, we will set three major energy goals for America. One, to reduce greenhouse gas emissions 80% from 1990 levels by 2050, the amount necessary to avoid the most dangerous and destructive consequences of climate change. Two, to cut foreign oil imports by two-thirds from projected levels by 2030, to move America toward energy independence. And three, to move us from a carbon-based economy to an efficient, green economy by unleashing by unleashing a wave of private sector innovation in clean energy and energy efficiency. I believe that will create at least 5 million good new jobs from clean energy over the next decade. Now, how will we achieve these goals? Well, first, as president, I will lead a national commitment to energy efficiency. This is the cheapest, cleanest, fastest way to reduce energy consumption and save energy costs and to create good jobs that cannot be outsourced. The Department of Energy estimates that we can reduce energy use in residential buildings 20% by 2020. We can do better than that, I believe. By some estimates, all the future growth in energy demand in North America, all of it, could be met through investments in efficiency alone. And we know how to do this. We must change the way utilities make money. Today, the incentives are backwards. The less we conserve, the more carbon we emit, the more money utilities earn. We'll change that with energy efficiency targets for utilities and incentives for saving power instead of generating more of it. For two decades, U.S. fuel economy has stagnated. Cars and light trucks account for 40% of the 21 million barrels of oil consumed every day in America. As president, I will raise the fuel efficiency standards to 40 miles per gallon by 2020 and 55 by 2030. This is the new challenge. What does it mean to be a patriot for America in the 21st century? End our dependence on foreign oil and an old energy system that undermines our growth and our future. America can lead the world's green revolution. Our entrepreneurial capacity, our capital markets, our research institution, and our skilled workforce are unmatched. We are the best in the world. Let's start acting like we're the best again. This will create at least 5 million jobs. You've heard of white-collar jobs. You've heard of blue-collar jobs. These will be new green-collar jobs all across America. In my campaign, I have defined the four big goals for our country: restore our leadership in the world, rebuild a strong and prosperous middle class, reform our government, and reclaim the future for our children. Meeting the energy and climate change challenge is essential to reaching every one of those. I do not want to be part of the first generation to leave America and the world in worse shape than when we found them. It will not happen on my watch. If you want America to be in the solutions business again, if you want to end the destructive partisanship, if you want to bring people together, join with me in embracing one of the greatest challenges we've ever faced. It will be an exciting, noble, and rewarding adventure. We're going to open up the future to our children and grandchildren. And if we do it right, they will look back with pride on this moment when Americans came together to turn a threat to our future into the triumph of this new century. Thank you, and God bless you.
Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton speaking last month at the Clipper Wind Power Wind Turbine Factory in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Clinton, the former First Lady, represents New York State in the U.S. Senate. This is Word for Word from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Penkava, and this hour we're presenting highlights from the 8 Democratic presidential candidates on the stump in Iowa and New Hampshire. We had presented a similar program last week featuring the Republican candidates. Next, we'll hear from Senator Chris Dodd, currently in his 5th term representing the state of Connecticut. Dodd spoke November 6th as part of a series of candidate forums organized by the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council.
I hate to think that we've come to a point in our nation when we have to have candidates actually get up and talk about defending the Constitution of the United States. It's one thing to have a debate about health care or education policy, even the war in Iraq or Iran or what's going on in Pakistan. But it saddens me that we have to defend the Constitution. And yet there's nothing short of that as what is our obligation if we don't stand up and fight for this document and all the values included in it, then our nation will be something far less than what we inherited the responsibility of caring for. So I have made the commitment that when asked the question, what's the first thing you'll do on January 20th, 2009, if you are elected President of the United States, and the first thing I will do by executive order is to restore the Constitution of the United States to the American people. And I want to tell you why this afternoon. Today, in the early years of the 21st century, our defining question is a very simple one. Can we defend America if we fail to defend our Constitution and the rule of law? That's not a loaded question. There are a lot of good people, a good number of Americans, who say the answer to that question is yes. They don't understand that question. They don't understand that question lightly. They are well-intentioned. They believe that the terrorist threat that we're facing is so vast, so unprecedented, that parts of our Constitution become luxuries, and that the Geneva Conventions has become, in the words of a former attorney general, quaint. The height of this false dichotomy came on September 28th of last year, the day the United States Senate voted to pass President Bush's Military Commissions Act. That was the day the United States Senate gave in to fear. The Senate was frightened out of the rule of law and into the waiting arms of the rule of men. The United States Senate gave President Bush everything he wanted. It gave him the power to designate any individual an unlawful enemy combatant, hold that individual indefinitely, and take away the right of habeas corpus, the 900-year-old right to challenge your detention. And worst of all, the Military Commissions Act gave President Bush the power to get information out of suspected terrorists by any means, the power to use evidence gained from torture, which historically has proven to be so unreliable. I spoke against that disgraceful bill. I voted against that disgraceful bill. But unfortunately, I was in a very small minority that day in September. Because of that decision and others like it, America is making itself known to the world not for what we accomplished on the beaches of Normandy, not for what we created with the Marshall Plan, not for the moral authority born at Nuremberg, moral authority that fortified America's leadership and helped to create international institutions that serve the common good and security of all nations for 60 years, from the United Nations to NATO to the IMF. Rather, America is increasingly known today for Abu Ghraib, for Guantanamo. Put simply, the President's military commissions exist to protect abusive behavior. Let me be clear, if I can, to all of you this afternoon. Under very clearly prescribed circumstances, military commissions can be useful, a useful instrument for bringing our enemies to justice, but not under the absurd set of strictures that pass for justice in some circles in the year 2007. President Bush insists that the government does not use torture. Waterboarding isn't torture, is posed as a question. Malcolm Nance is a 26-year-old expert in intelligence and counterterrorism, a combat veteran and former chief of training for the U.S. Navy's Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape School, who has trained American soldiers to resist interrogation. Listen to Malcolm Nance, if you will. He writes, "Waterboarding does not simulate drowning. The victim is drowning. Slow motion suffocation. When done right, it is controlled death," if you quote him. Now, if you'd rather use some other euphemism, enhanced interrogation, feel free. Just as long as everyone understands that you're talking about a technique invented by the Spanish Inquisition and perfected by the Khmer Rouge. That, my friends, is waterboarding. It is torture. This administration believes it is legal. Mine will not, because there is no place in it in my America, and I hope yours as well. I think we are better than this. I believe we are better than this. We Americans understand it is not always the example of our force that has kept us safe, but rather the force of our example. We understand that our leaders do not swear to support and defend the Constitution or protect the country. That is a false choice. Rather, we defend the Constitution and the rule of law and the values it expresses precisely to protect our country. America's moral authority isn't incidental to our security. It is at its very foundation, in my view. Restoring our belief in this most fundamental of American principles is the challenge, the most significant challenge we face today. And so I ask in Iowa today, can we? The whole world is waiting for that answer. And I thank you for listening this afternoon.
Connecticut Senator Chris Dodd, who is seeking the Democratic nomination for president, speaking last month in Iowa City. His talk was part of a series of candidate forums organized by the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council. This hour on Word for Word, we are featuring excerpts from all of the Democratic presidential candidates. We featured the Republicans last week. As we move down the list in alphabetical order, the next candidate we'll hear from is former North Carolina Senator John Edwards in a speech he gave this October in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Edwards, who ran for president in 2004 and was the Democratic Party's vice presidential nominee that year, is hoping to be on the top of the ticket this time around. In a speech unveiling his proposal to curb the use of private military contractors, Edwards used part of his time to criticize the proposed Iraq policy of presumed Democratic frontrunner Hillary Clinton.
She said that she would continue to conduct combat missions in Iraq. My view is if you're not ending combat missions and combat operations, you're not ending the war. And let me be very specific about what I'd do. I would draw 40,000 to 50,000 troops out immediately, and then I would continue to withdraw all of our combat troops so that all of our combat troops were out in about 9 or 10 months. And the only thing that would be left, the only troops that would be left in Iraq are those that are necessary to guard the embassy. And then we'd also got to determine if there are humanitarian workers in Iraq, whether it might be necessary to have some troops there for that purpose, but not for purposes of war and not for purposes of conducting combat operations. The war needs to be brought to an end. And the debate I want to have with whoever the Republican nominee is about whether or not to end the war. I want to be on the podium with them arguing that we must end this war in Iraq and allow them to argue, if they want to, that we should continue the war. But the debate that Senator Clinton seems to want to have is about how much war we should have. Well, I think we should have none. We should leave it to the Republicans to offer four more years of George Bush's mess. Our party has to offer the American people real and serious and substantial change. Now, my view is our Iraq policy has been a disaster from the beginning. I've said before, I voted for this war, and I was wrong to vote for this war. And I took responsibility for that very clearly. And I've apologized for having voted for the war and said I was wrong, which is another difference between myself and Senator Clinton. But the American people voted to end this war this November of 2006. What they said is they don't want status quo anymore. They want to see real change. And it's an outrage that what they've gotten is status quo. Today's all-volunteer force was designed precisely to avoid a president being able to conduct a war against the will of the American people. By linking military decisions to a force made up of volunteer professional soldiers, wars could not be launched and sustained without the support of the people. The Bush administration is keeping the war in Iraq going despite the overwhelming opposition of America. And they're doing it by performing an end run around our all-volunteer force. They're relying instead, as many of you have seen, on private security contractors like Blackwater. The president's relying on contractors precisely because his dangerous mismanagement of the Iraq war has required and he has chosen to outsource many of our security functions. About 50,000 private contractors are currently working on security and military missions in Iraq. So here's what I want to do. We're going to end George Bush's outsourcing of America's security responsibilities to private contractors. My plan for reforming security contractors in Iraq has five basic pieces. First, we're going to restore democracy to our military. As Commander-in-Chief, I will transfer most security missions currently performed by contractors back to military command, where they belong. Only in the rarest exception will that not be true. I'll also require that any future security contractors work under very narrow exceptions and clearly within the Pentagon chain of command. Second, we will expand legal oversight and prosecutions. As president, I'll ask Congress to amend every relevant statute to cover all of our security contractors. We also need to make sure not only that we have laws, but in fact we enforce them. As president, I will work with the Attorney General to ensure alleged crimes by contractors are always investigated and prosecuted. And finally, I'll charge my National Security Advisor with establishing clear rules for engagement for contractors. There should never be any mystery about when a contractor can use force and the consequences for acting improperly. Third, I'll get cronyism out of these contracts. As president, I'll ask Congress to pass legislation prohibiting campaign contributions by applicants for and recent recipients of security contracts, extending the ban on current contractors. I'll also ask Congress to pass legislation to close the revolving door for government contractors by preventing former officials from working as contractors with business before their former offices for 5 years. Fourth, we'll establish strong quality control measures and accountability. We have seen too much mismanagement and too many poor personnel decisions under the Bush administration. As president, I'll charge my national security advisor with establishing a regular system of quality assurance evaluations of security contractors. I'll also make sure that any agency still using security contractors exercise clear oversight. And then finally, I'll require a total evaluation of the role and expense of these contractors. As president, I'll order my Secretary of Defense to perform a comprehensive accounting of all contractors performing security operations during my first 6 months in office. I've also proposed a new national security budget that will include all security activities by the Pentagon, the State Department, and other agencies. And I'll require this budget to include all funding requests for all contractors so that Congress can better evaluate the role and value of security contractors. America used to be the beacon of the world, and our all-volunteer force is one of the proudest democratic institutions that we have. And as we learned during Vietnam, decisions about war and peace should always be decisions made by a democracy, not despite it. But under the Bush administration and people like Blackwater, this beacon is flickering. And they are now performing an end run around the Democratic military. That's why Iraq's still going, 10 months after the American people voted to end it. With the steps I've talked about here today, we can finally get hold of our security contracting situation. We can move beyond the president's terrible mismanagement of Iraq. We can make sure that no one ever performs an end run around our all-volunteer military. We can make sure that those who commit crimes in the name of America are prosecuted under the law. We can light the beacon of America's moral leadership once again, and we can restore democracy to our proud military, and we can make sure that scandals like Blackwater become forever a thing of the past.
Democratic presidential candidate and former North Carolina Senator John Edwards, who was John Kerry's running mate in the 2004 presidential election. We just heard an excerpt of him speaking in October in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. This is Word for Word from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava, and this hour on the program, we are featuring the Democratic presidential candidates on the stump in New Hampshire and Iowa. Last week, we heard from the Republicans. Next up on the program this hour, former Alaska Senator Mike Gravel. Speaking earlier this summer in Bedford, New Hampshire, Gravel explained his proposal to bring a swift end to the Iraq War.
I view the problem in two steps. One, get our people out. Then the next step is to how to handle the situation and heal it. And there is a way. I don't buy Joe Biden's approach that, oh, it's all going to go hell in a handbasket. That's what we heard in Vietnam, you know. We get out of Vietnam, all the dominoes are going to fall, Southeast Asia is going to... Didn't happen. And it won't happen. There'll be some killing. There's a civil war going on. Let's not mix, we understand that. But to say that Iran, Saudi Arabia, Syria, Lebanon, Turkey, that these people aren't going to weigh in to try to bring about some stability, they all got a stake in that. And so if we can pull our troops out and then turn around and with aggressive diplomacy, bring in Russia, bring in China, of course, stop the arms race that Bush is trying to instigate with these countries, but bring them all in and weigh in. And I think we can have a rapid solution to the problem there and focus on, of course, the solution between the Israeli and Palestinians. And I think that that is first and foremost if we're ever going to see a diminution of the confrontation between the Islamic world and the... And that would... That would be my top. End of war, and immediately that would be number one, right hitting the ground running. I do have a solution. I just want to share it with you because I think it would work. All you've got to do, first off, the bill that I have is a nice bill. it says that if the president, the vice president, the secretary of defense, and the secretary of treasury do not certify that all the troops are out in 120 days, they commit a felony and they're liable for 5 years in jail without possibility of parole. Okay. Now, the first thing somebody will say, well, my God, how can you get that passed? You know, the president will veto. Of course he's going to veto it. And of course they're going to filibuster it. But what do? This is where it takes some leadership. Now, don't let everybody just say, this is Pelosi and Reid. This is the four other members of the Senate who are running for the president of the United States. If they got leadership, now's the time to show it. Okay? Now, of course, they all voted for the war except Obama. But now's the time they can do penance and show leadership. But, of course, that's not what's happening. Here's how it works. Real simple. Filibuster in the Senate, let them do it. And then you have a vote on Monday at noon. Then you have a vote on Tuesday at noon. A vote on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. No weekends off, 7 days a week. No vacations. You all got to stay there and vote every day. Now, that vote is only a half hour long. And so that means that they can do a lot of other work for you during all that time. And I promise you, within 20 days, you'll have cloture overridden. The law will pass. Bush will veto it. Comes back to the House and the Senate. Now you got to override the veto. You've got to get more votes. Well, what? And then you have first day, vote to override. Don't do it. Second day, third day, fourth day. I tell you, within 40 days, it's overridden. Because I know how politicians feel. You're talking about their survival. Let them hang in a wind. Let them just turn around. You'll watch them turn before your very eyes. But what's going on in this dynamic process is it's a confrontation. It's a constitutional confrontation between the Congress of the United States, which is the only body that has the power to make law, and the executive, which does not have the power to make law, and the American people. But what you need is a process that is strung out so the American people have the time to weigh in and put the pressure and get the peace movements to go after these people one at a time where they live at their home districts.
Former Alaska Senator Mike Gravel speaking earlier this summer in Bedford, New Hampshire. Next up on Word for Word, as we feature the Democratic presidential candidate's stump speeches, Ohio Congressman Dennis Kucinich. Kucinich gave this speech as part of a symposium on ending America's dependence on nuclear energy and fossil fuels. The symposium was held November 27th at the New Hampshire Technical Institute in Concord.
Ice sheets are melting, sea levels rising. If we don't correct the course, we're going to see catastrophic impact. We all know that. Isn't this interesting? We actually have the science that can look into the future, that can forecast where we're headed. And we know we're headed over a cliff in our energy policies. How about we change directions? Is that asking for too much? Now, I know, you know, it's challenging to run for president at a time when these energy industries have enormous influence, where people are advocating more mining, advocating more coal, advocating continuation on this path of using hydrocarbon-based energy and oil. But we finally are seeing the link between global warming and global warring, resource wars. We see it. Is there anyone who has a shred of common sense who doesn't know that we went into Iraq because of oil? Henry Kissinger just about said so in the Washington Post. We're not there to help the government. We're there to secure America's national interest. We are grabbing other people's resources in the name of the national interest, pursuing policies that are absolutely antithetical to our national interest, both our energy policy and our national security, because we are less safe as a nation from the invasion of Iraq. This is just incontrovertible proof. Occupation fuels insurgency. Kill 1 million innocent Iraqis. Less safe. So, we need to, at this moment, begin to recognize the enormous amount of work that's already been done in alternative energies, particularly in wind and solar. What I advocate is making government an engine of sustainability in this way. Imagine an American president who tells the American people every area of the federal government is going to be involved in sustainability. Transportation department, mass transit. Give people a viable mass transit like we had 100 years ago in America, an interurban. that enabled people to get around without having to rely on automobiles before the automobile age. You go to Europe, you see what it looks like. You can get around the big cities using trains, and people do. They wouldn't think of taking cars. And you need cars for trips to visit relatives, you can do that. But for ordinary mass transit, job, school, people get around. Transportation moves towards rail. Housing and urban development, green housing, recycled materials, natural lighting, passive solar. We take a whole new approach towards our housing programs. The Energy Department, stop incentivizing oil, coal, nuclear. Take those subsidies out. Isn't it interesting? We're being told that nuclear is so cheap, but the government has to fund the industry to prop it up. Wow. You know? We're being told that this is the way, and yet if without the government subsidies, these utilities go down. We need to stop subsidizing these utilities, but take resources and incentivize wind, solar, and green energy. Let me give you an idea. Imagine this. Imagine if we use the productive capacity of America and create millions of jobs building wind and solar microtechnologies, which we then apply to tens of millions of homes and businesses, as well as to insulate those homes and businesses. We create jobs, prime the pump of the economy, lower our energy costs, and lower our use of carbon-based energy. This is possible. This isn't like a pipe dream. There are off-the-shelf technologies that people can install right now, but with the government using its productive capacity and its monetary resources, we start to pour it into creating the kind of technologies which everyone could have. Everyone. We know the kind of resources it takes for people to power a home. Imagine if we shift away from oil and coal and nuclear. This idea of a works green administration, where government becomes the engine of sustainability, goes towards enlisting the inventive genius of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. Now, John Kennedy, when he was president, inspired a generation of young Americans to reach for the stars, study technology, science, help America reach for outer space. Well, our journey now is more earthbound. We have to save our planet. It's the path to the future. It's a path for peace and sustainability. It's a path to repairing our planet. And it's a path to enlist the American people in a common effort as citizens to sustain this planet. We're really at the threshold of a whole new era of possibilities where we can restore the Earth, heal it, and heal our relationship to nature, have the energy that we need and the prosperity that we hope for. It's all possible, carbon-free and nuclear-free. Thank you very much.
Democratic presidential candidate and Ohio Congressman Dennis Kucinich speaking November 27th in Concord, New Hampshire. This is Word for Word from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava. And this hour on the program, we're featuring stump speeches from all of the Democratic presidential candidates. As we did in last week's show with the Republican presidential hopefuls, we're presenting the candidates in alphabetical order. And that brings us next to first-term Illinois Senator Barack Obama. Obama's campaign received a dose of star power this month when TV talk show diva Oprah Winfrey joined him for a series of packed campaign appearances. One of those was this December 9th event in Manchester, New Hampshire. Obama, who is often more subdued on the campaign trail, was, to use his own phrase, fired up that day.
They're fired up! Ready to go! Fired up! Ready to go! Oh, everybody is ready. And you know, when you talk to folks, whether it's at the shipyard or home care workers or teachers or nurses, they all have the same idea about America. They don't want government to solve all their problems. They don't expect that. They know they've got to work hard. They know they've got to take pride in their work. They know that they have to be responsible for their families. And they know there are going to be struggles once in a while. They understand that. But you know what they do hope for is that if they're able and willing to work and they've done a good job, they should be able to have a job that pays a living wage. They believe that they shouldn't be bankrupt when they get sick. That they should be able to send their child to a good school that teaches them what they need to learn, and that they should be able to go to college even if they're not wealthy. They believe that they should be able to retire with some dignity and some respect. They don't want America hated around the world because they love their country. That's what you believe. That's why I'm in it. That's why I'm in it. See, I'm in it because I want those voices to be heard in Washington. I'm in it to tell the companies that are shipping jobs overseas, we're taking away their tax breaks. We're putting them in the pockets of hardworking Americans right here in the United States of America. I'm in it to say that my trade policy, my labor policy, is going to be looking out for workers. We're not just going to be looking after Wall Street. We're going to be looking after Main Street when I'm president of the United States of America. I'm running because I'm tired of talking about the outrage of 47 million people without health insurance. I want to start doing something about it. And this is personal for me. Some of you heard this story. My mother died when she was 53 years old of ovarian cancer. And that was tragic enough because she never got a chance to meet her gorgeous grandchildren. But what compounded the tragedy was the fact that in those last months, she wasn't thinking about getting well. She was reading insurance forms because she had just gotten a new job. And the insurance company was saying, well, maybe, you know, this was a pre-existing condition. Maybe we don't have to reimburse for your health care. And I was furious when I saw that happen. See, I know what it's like to see a loved one suffer, not just because of an illness, but because of a broken healthcare system. And that is why I have put forward a plan to make sure that every American can get healthcare that they can count on, that's as good as the healthcare I have as a member of Congress. And we're not going to wait 20 years from now. We're not going to wait 10 years from now. We are going to do it by the end of my first term as President of the United States of America. It's time to get that done. It is time to get it done. I'm in this race to make sure that every child has the best education that America has to offer, from the day they're born to the day they graduate from college. And I won't be a president who just talks about how great teachers are. I am going to reward them for their greatness by giving them higher salaries and giving them more support and invested in early childhood education. And I don't know about you, but I think it might be about time to make sure that college is affordable and accessible for every American young person. We are a wealthy nation. We can afford it. I will do that when I am president of the United States of America. I'm in this race because I'm tired of folks thinking that the only way to look tough on national security is to talk and act and vote like George Bush. I intend to end this war in Iraq and bring our troops home within 16 months. As president, I will finish the fight against Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, the war we should have focused on in the first place. When I'm the Democratic nominee, my opponent won't be able to say, well, you voted for the war too, because I didn't. They won't be able to say that, well, you don't believe in talking to leaders we don't like, because I've said that does not make any sense. John F. Kennedy once said, we should never negotiate out of fear, but we should never fear to negotiate. Strong countries and strong presidents talk to their adversaries and tell them where America stands. That's what I intend to do as president of the United States of America. I'm in this race because I know that the only reason I'm standing here today, the only reason that Oprah Winfrey is here, the only reason that Michelle Obama is here, the only reason that so many of us are here is because somebody, somewhere, stood up when it was risky. They stood up when it was hard. They stood up when it wasn't popular. They stood up so women could have the right to vote. They stood up so unions could have the right to organize. They stood up so that African Americans could have a seat at the table. They stood up in the face of prison. They stood up in the face of threats. That's what we need to do right now. We've got to stand up for America. Stand up for equality. Stand up for justice. Stand up for our children. That's why I'm running. That's why you're here. Let's take back America. God bless you, New Hampshire.
Democratic presidential candidate and Illinois Senator Barack Obama speaking December 9th at a rally in Manchester, New Hampshire, one of his campaign events that was headlined by media star Oprah Winfrey. Finally, this hour on Word for Word, as we feature the Democratic presidential candidates on the stump, we're going to hear from New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson. Richardson is a former congressman and was America's ambassador to the United Nations during the Clinton administration. Here's what Richardson had to say this August at the Iowa State Fair.
We need change in this country. We're a deeply divided America. The Iraq War, health care, a middle class that wants a voice. The fact that every American deserves the best possible health care. The fact that we need to become energy independent. But this is what I will do on my first day as president. I will get our troops out of Iraq. And it will be with a diplomatic plan to ensure that there's a reconciliation, a partition, a division of oil among the three groups, an all-Muslim peacekeeping force. And we will have Iran and Syria participate in a new scheme of peace for the region. We'll focus on the Middle East issue. But none of this can happen without bringing all our kids home. And then I commit to you that we will take care of our veterans in this country. And here's my plan for health care for our veterans. From now on, every one of our vets will get a hero's health card, and they can get their health care anywhere they want. The second day that I'm in office, I will announce a plan to revitalize America's schools. And the first thing that I will do, I'll get rid of No Child Left Behind. And we will have a minimum wage for all our teachers. The key to a good education is a strong teacher. We'll have a minimum wage for all our teachers, $40,000 per year. And we will have preschool for every child, full-day kindergarten. We've got to upgrade our science and math. We need to upgrade our high school curriculums with a strong program of languages, civics, but also as a key to unlock our kids in science and math, a new federal program to increase art in the schools. And we will also have a universal scholarship for all our college students. If we can spend $450 billion in Iraq, we can educate America's kids. And I have a plan for all college students to pay off your college loans, or a good part of it. Here's my plan. Will you give 1 year of national service to your country and you pay off a bunch of your loans? The third day I'm in office, I'll announce a plan to have health care for every American. And here is the plan. No matter who you are, every American should be entitled to the best possible health care. And we can do it because we spend $2.2 trillion on health care. And 31% goes to HMOs. 31% goes to insurance companies. We've got to find ways to get the doctor-patient relationship started again and cut out a lot of the red tape that these industries that are ripping us off. And we need to be sure that we emphasize prevention, give incentives to companies that let their employees work out and get healthier. And with our health care plan, we lower Medicare to 55 so more participate. And we allow anybody in this country to be part of the best health care plan in America. And that is one that Congress have. As the Congress has it, we all should have it. And we can do this in this country. I also want to have an America that has an economy for America's middle class, that protects the pensions of our workers, that protects the health care costs that are struggling and spiraling, that makes sure that wages stay up to inflation. We should never have another trade bill that ships jobs overseas. We should be sure that we have an economy in this country that says to the private sector, If you create jobs over the prevailing wage, we will find a way to give you a tax incentive. And we've got to be sure that this $9 trillion debt that has been created by this administration is eliminated, and we protect Social Security, we protect Medicare, we protect health care and education for our people. And that is going to take eventually a major effort to balance the budget, a line item veto, get rid of corporate welfare, get rid of earmarks. But we got to be tough to balance our budget so our social programs and investments in America happen. My last point is energy. We need an energy revolution. We have to shift from fossil fuels to solar, to wind, to biomass, to biofuels, biodiesel, to distributed generation. And we've got to say to the oil companies and the coal companies and the nuclear companies that you no longer will guide energy policy in America. The last points I want to make. If I'm elected president, I commit to you that I will follow the Constitution of the United States and that I will not go to war without the consent of Congress and that I will get rid of those examples of terrible American human rights policy like Guantanamo. And we're going to say that torture as a tool in our foreign policy is now gone, and we're not going to eavesdrop on our citizens unless there's a court order. And now I want to just close with this. One, we need a candidate that can change this country, that knows how to make change. We need a candidate that has experience. And then we need a candidate that can win next year, that is electable. And I believe I'm that candidate.
Democratic presidential candidate and New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson speaking this summer at the Iowa State Fair. Richardson is one of eight candidates seeking the Democratic Party's nomination for president next year. And we've heard highlights from all of their stump speeches this hour on Word for Word. If you missed part of the program, or if you would just like to hear it again, just visit our website. It's wordforword.org. There, you may listen to full-length versions of all of the speeches we featured on today's program, and all of the speeches from last week's program, which showcased the Republican presidential candidates on the stump. That's all at wordforword.org. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Word for Word. For American Public Media, I'm Melinda Pencava.
Word for Word is produced by Curtis Gilbert, with associate producer Patty Ray Rudolph and technical director Sam Keenan. Special thanks this week to New Hampshire Public Radio, Iowa Public Radio, and the website prx.org.
American Public Media.